So I'm happy to be here with you. I get to come here once or twice a year, so I always like to come. I may have shared this in the past. Some of you may know I'm a co-founder of an organization based in Oakland called Mindful Schools. Some of you may know that organization. And we train educators to have a whole curriculum to bring mindfulness and, you know, self-awareness, empathy, kindness kind of teachings into their classrooms. And we recently lost our executive director, and I was asked to step in as an interim executive director until we have a search going on for a new one. And probably it looks like I'll be in the role maybe for, could be as long as 9 months, something like that. And it's been interesting because I haven't had, I guess you'd say, a real job for a while. And I worked for many years in Silicon Valley. My degree's in electrical engineering. I work for the large semiconductor companies. So I'm used to having a job. And I still have things I'm involved in life, but not an actual job. And so I was wondering, well, how's it going to be? And it sort of was mixed for me. In some ways, I think it's been good for me. It's like I actually can get up. And it's not, I'm being a little humorous, but, you know, have commitments and where I have to be. And I think I'm doing a reasonable job in the interim role. I've had some management experience, but not at executive director level. I've been more of a lower level management kind of experience before in engineering roles. So, but I think I'm doing an okay job. What's been interesting is I've been in this role for about 2.5 or 3 months now, and it's been quite stressful. The organization is doing really well, and I feel I really very much believe in its mission. But and so mostly, you know, 90%, 95% everything's great, but you come in and you see what's, you know, like in any organization, kind of what's not working well, where there's difficulties, challenges, and I won't go into the details of it, but you know, the, let's just say the 95% that's working well is working really well, and the whatever 5 or 10% that's not is really messed up. And it's been a challenge. And so rather than come in and being in a holding pattern to just have someone needs to be in the role until a new ED comes in, there are things that needed to be dealt with. And again, I won't go into any details, but just been on a lot of levels, it's been quite stressful. And I've been having a pretty difficult time settling myself and calming myself in the midst of this. As we all know, the mind and body, you can't really separate them out. And so both affect the, each affect the other and affects the other, and they're both doorways into the other. So you can think of, if you need to, if you're having some stress or anything you're dealing with, you can go through, work with your mind, and that can calm the mind but also calm the body. Or the body itself is a doorway, right? And then that can bring the mind down. My wife is a psychotherapist. She's trained in a somatic-oriented psychotherapist, so I think it's from her influence. I've been much more looking at the body as the doorway, and I even pick up some of her terminology, and the way I would say it is I notice I have not been able to regulate my nervous system. That's a, you'll hear that terminology among somatic therapists, and it's been true. I could feel it in the body. There's like a jangly energy, and I couldn't calm down. And to the point where, like, for example, I don't often need to take sleep medicines to help me, but sometimes I do. I have some prescription things. Like if I travel and I'm really having trouble sleeping, I've got a good pill, it really makes me sleep. Or I can take herbal things. I have a whole array depending on what I think I'll need. And, you know, here and there in my life, I need them, but most of the time I sleep okay on my own. Really, I couldn't sleep. I'm having to really getting kind of heavily dependent on the sleep aids. You know, I'd wake up at 3 a.m. It's like, oh, I've got to email somebody. You know, it just was really hard to to compartmentalize and set it down. And it was also hard to just not be entangled in this. And this word entanglement I want to come back to a little bit. And I've got a lot of tools in my toolkit. I've been meditating a long time. I consider myself of maybe average natural ability to be able to calm and settle my mind. I've been doing it for a lot of years pretty intensively. So, and this is no great claim, what I'm about to say may be true for many of you here, but I can close my eyes and in a few breaths, I'm deep in what you call samadhi or concentration. It's great. I go to these beautiful places. As soon as I come out, it's still right there. It's like, okay, that's not working. You know, so that's a tool, and I'm sure it had some benefits, but, you know, it's like I feel tired, my eyes are burning, I feel this jangly energy in my body. I can meditate. It does give me a refuge and a relief, but then I come back, it's all waiting right there. Okay, that's not working. Trying many, all the tools in my toolkit to calm and settle myself in the midst of a challenging situation. And we want to be able to do that. You know, that's important to calm ourselves. But what I found helped me and made a big shift was when I think it was natural for me to approach it this way, find all the ways to calm myself, settle my nervous system through the body, through the mind, all these different techniques. Go for walks in nature, soak in a hot tub, you name it. But then at one point, just recently, I finally just kind of stopped that whole approach and I just said, okay, this isn't shifting for me. And I was suffering a lot. And so I asked myself just a simple question. Can I be with this? Just ask myself the question. And it was amazing. Excuse me. Just by asking myself the question before the answer came, there was something just kind of safe and inviting and just inviting me just to say, well, maybe you can and maybe you can't, you know, but just check, and something immediately just relaxed. And I noticed that, and the answer came, yeah, I can be with this. I can't make it go away, but I can be with this. And in that realization was a settling of a different kind, and then that can lead to other settlings. So I want to come back because really what I'm naming here was two kinds of approaches to working with any situation, certainly any pleasant or unpleasant, but I'm focusing more on working with any kind of challenges or difficulties. We want to have the ability to bring down the intensity if we can, calm ourselves, relax more. But we also, these two, it's kind of an artificial way to separate them out, but just as a way of speaking, I think we also want to learn how to just be with something, even if we're not able to bring it down. Because, I mean, isn't it true that if there's a situation for which we're not able to settle out and calm ourselves or find a relief in changing the experience itself, and we're not able to find a way to be present with it, that's a lot of suffering. That's real suffering. And many of us, you know, I want to be careful and not, you know, respectful, not trigger anyone off. I'm sure, I'm guessing there's about 30 of us here. I don't know if people are going to want to share. I'm planning to leave some time for discussion. I don't know what people will say, but I'm guessing there are people. We could tell, all of us have our stories of maybe some of us are dealing with long-term chronic situations or different kinds of pain on many aspects of or suffering, and we all know what it's like when, there are times when I'm able to shift my circumstances or be less stressful, or okay, I need to go for a walk to just in the woods or whatever, you're listen to your favorite music or read poetry or look at art or I don't know, whatever it is, and maybe that can really shift things. But we also know what it's like when maybe we're in a situation and boy, the way out is not so obvious, and then maybe our task really is to just find the way. Is there a way? Really, it's kind of an inquiry, it's a question. Can I be with this or not? And if the question's not, all right, then we, you know, really, if that's the case, we do the best we can. I mean, that's the answer. You do the best you can. So I want to come back to that because I want to talk about a metaphor. I think I may have brought this here in the past to this group. I use it a lot. But there's a metaphor of that the Buddha used as he's recorded in the traditional texts around fire. And there's this idea of, you know, I've had times when I've been suffering and I didn't know the way to let go. And it can feel like you're burning in a sense. I mean, it's metaphorically burning. I remember a time when I was, well, now I laugh. I wasn't laughing at the time. This is how bad it was. So I'd been away teaching a meditation retreat. So you'd think I would know better. And I was flying back into town, into the San Francisco airport, and I happened to land at a time that was near rush hour traffic time at the end of the day. And in addition, unbeknownst to me, there was a, I guess when the 49ers, I think there was a football game getting out, or I forgot, some combination of some event getting out and the rush hour traffic, and it was really bad. It took me, you know, an extra hour. I live in Oakland, to go from an hour longer than normal. And to top it off, I hadn't eaten and I was tired, and so I was feeling particularly, this is my excuse, that particularly edgy because my blood sugar was low and I was hungry. And it was back when my son was really young, and he was fine, but I don't go away that much because I don't like to leave my family that much, but occasionally. But I missed him a lot. So all of that was together, and I was just like, and I was in this traffic, and I was just pissed off. And it was all these other people. You know, I didn't notice that I'm the traffic for them, you know. But my car's taking up space too, but all these people, and I was, it felt like I was burning in just ill will. You know, I don't know if hatred's kind of a strong word. I actually don't shy away from the word hatred because I don't want to make it worse than it is, but I like to, you know, it can feel like it's a mind of ill will, right? And I knew what was happening. And to make it worse, there was no one to blame. So I knew there was nothing to do. It was just what was happening. I knew I was going to be home in an hour more. I called on my phone and talked to my son. He's fine. Everything's fine. I couldn't let go of the suffering. So then, you know, at some point you just have to say, all right, it's this. And then maybe you just have to, can I just be with this? And that in itself, again, is an example of a way of, you know, if you've tried everything else and you know, you still get, look, the whole Dharma, one way I think of it is, as human beings, I don't think we're going to stop trying to aim our lives in the way we want it to be, right? Who's going to stop doing that? No one's going to try to have less of what you want happen to you happen and more of what you don't want to have happen to you happen to you. Nobody's going to do that because we're human beings, right? I don't think that's what the Buddha was asking about. So, of course, we're going to want to take care of ourselves, aim our lives in the way it should be, and all of that. And then, despite our best efforts, at the end of the day, you're going to get whatever you get. And one way to think of the whole Dharma from a practice point of view is, okay, what are you going to do with you get what you get? And so it's just this cliche, but it's so simple, it's conceptually simple of just coming back moment to moment to what's actually, you know, it's the cliche to say, well, there's only the present moment. But I mean, really, there's only the present moment, and there's just what's happening. And then it's what's needed. So for me, in my practice, it's really shifted over the years. I still have a daily meditation practice. And I've been practicing a lot of years, but really I find the leading edge of my practice is not about sitting in formal meditation. It's all the rest of the time of just going about my business, living my life. And really moment to moment for me, and I'll just offer it, you can see if this is of any use to you or not, it's really simple. I'm either caught in some kind of clinging or not. My heart's either contracted and closed off, or it's open with loving kindness. So when I'm caught in clinging, let go. When my heart's caught in is in ill will or it's not very kind, open the heart. Let go, open the heart. And during the times when the heart is open and I'm not clinging, I don't have to do anything. You just live. Nothing needed. Right? It's simple. It's not so simple, of course, because it's so easy. This is one of the main reasons people meditate and do formal practices for many reasons, of course. But one, most of us share, it's we know that when we hear things like this or all the different ways we hear Dharma, it's not conceptually difficult. All the lists are difficult. Buddhism is complicated. Dharma is not. It's not. And, you know, I've got in my house, I have literally shelves filled with books. When I first got into Dharma, I was 17 years old. It was 1970, and I wanted to know, like, what's Buddhism? What's Dharma? What's the history and development of Buddhism? What's Zen? What's Mahayana? And so, you know, you don't have to be into it, but I'm not a scholar, but I consider myself to be an educated practitioner. And so I really read most of the books on my shelf about what are the teachings, and I know some about history and development of Buddhism and different schools, and I wanted to know this, and there's teachings in many forms and commentaries and all this, and I really threw myself in a lot. And actually, it used to be that back then, by the fact, some of you may have heard of an organization called the Sati Center for Buddhist Studies. Any of you know the Sati Center? So I'm the co-founder. I actually had the idea for the Sati Center. And then I went to Gil Fronsdahl and a few other people, and they thought it was a good idea. We formed this thing. There weren't places for formal study so much back in those days. Now, you know, it's really wonderful. There's just so many opportunities around. So we wanted to do that. You know, and back in those days, if someone wanted to know something about a Pali Sutta, no, people would say, oh, go ask Shankman. And then, I don't know, didn't know everything, but, you know, I'd be like, they'd ask me something, and I don't know how, they'd be like, oh, yeah, that's in Samyutta Nikaya 15.3 or whatever. And, you know, I think it's also in the Vinaya, and I go, look, yep, and I just was into it, you know. None of that is Dharma. That's Buddhism. Now, it's an important, if that happens to be the framework that's supportive for you, there's many, many frameworks, then I have found it to be very important. It was part of my path. You don't have to go study all that stuff, but, you know, whatever it is that we each find, you know, so I'm not being dismissive of it. I actually have a tremendous appreciation for suttas and the lists and all that stuff, because that's, we all need a structure. We all need a... right, a path. Because if you just say to any of us, don't cling, keep your heart open in love, and that's all you need to know. And if someone says, well, you know, but okay, I'm signing up for that, that's a good idea. Well, you know that it doesn't take long before you find out that you can't do it. I mean, you can do it in a given moment, but it's hard to keep up because we just fall right back into, we become entangled. I used that word earlier, right? We just get lost and caught in things. And sometimes when that happens, someone will say, oh, I just went unconscious. And we know what is meant, but you didn't go unconscious, you're conscious. But you're just on what I call automatic pilot. You know what I mean? You just are caught up or entangled in things. And that's different than having an awareness in the moment of what's happening. So going back to what I was saying about, you know, either driving home from the great Dharma teacher, driving home from the retreat, pissed off because I'm not getting my ways, right? or, you know, now I'm at mindful school, something that's, it's a good thing to be there. It's not bad. It's just too much of a good thing. Right, and I'm stressed, and I can't settle whatever it is. Right, It's one thing to be caught up in it and you're just pissed off, you're whatever. And it's a different thing to be able to just know what's happening and to know you still feel it, right? Isn't that true? You know, New Age music didn't suddenly start playing when all of a sudden I realized that I'm creating my own suffering sitting here. It felt the same, but it gave me a possibility for freedom was there. And then either can I now bring in some of the tools and techniques that we develop with experience and time and try to just settle and let go. Maybe I send some loving kindness for the other people in there. Maybe they're having just as bad a time as I am. And you know, I'm clogging up the road for them or whatever. Or can I just be with this and just let it be? Right? Sometimes that's what we have to do. But we need to have enough awareness in the moment to be able to make these skillful choices. And even then, sometimes it's hard to do. You know, have you ever had, this is what I'm about to say has certainly happened to me, times when whatever the energy of something was so strong that even though I knew, I didn't want to let the, in that moment, I'm not even going to, fortunately, you're all fortunate because I've reached a point since November and January 20th, February, March, where I'm no longer using political examples for Dharma talk. So yes, I'm done with that. I do owe a debt of gratitude. I just want to express to those certain unnamed people in power right now, because sometimes it's hard to come up with Dharma talks. I'm like, no problem. So that's been helpful. But let's just say I know what it's like to have times when I know I'm clinging, I know my heart is closed off in ill will, and I'm not even, the power's too strong. I'm not even ready to even, I'm not going there about how do I work with this. It's not, it's forget it. It's off my charts, right? We can have times like that in whatever's going on in our lives. That's when we need to bring a lot of kindness for ourselves, because we're human beings and we're going to have times like that. And if, in case you don't know, I'll just tell you ahead of time, you're going to have plenty more times like that. Welcome to the club. We're all in the club. Yeah? And so, of course, I hope we can hold ourselves with a lot of kindness then, and care and compassion, because really we're all doing the best we can. And I know how some people's minds work. They go, not everyone's. It's like, no, not me. I'm not doing the best I can. I could. No, you can't. This is what it looks like when you're doing the best you can. You want to know what the best you can looks like? Looks like this. Oh, no, but I'm so lazy. If you could be less lazy, you would. Yeah, but I get sucked into watching these stupid movies on TV when I should go to bed, and because of that, I don't wake up in time to meditate. If you could stop getting sucked in, you would. Got to give ourselves a break. But we can start to, over time, shift the condition patterns so that things do shift. So we start where we're at, and we do the best we can, and then things can start to shift. And so one thing that I found that's really helpful is resting back in the knowing. Really get, not in an arrogant, we don't want to be arrogant. Right? We don't want to think we know everything, but certainly, and nothing can help us or anything like that. But I don't think it's arrogant to get in touch with our good intention. Matter of fact, when we do the little closing metta, I was thinking I might shift, it's related to metta, but something about just a little reflection on being in touch with the goodness of our intentions. You wouldn't come to a Dharma, I don't think there's a few people here I've known, I've noticed a couple of people I've known over the years. I don't think there's anyone here I know well at all. Well. But I'm pretty confident that you wouldn't show up to a group like this whose purpose is around how can we live in a way that's more deeply in alignment and harmony with these beautiful, wholesome Dharma teachings. Doesn't matter how well or poorly we're pulling it off or manifesting it. Those are just the conditioned patterns of your mind. How do we get the conditions of our patterns of our mind? Sometimes we might know, sometimes we don't. But we got what we got. So even if we're not able to let go of clinging much, and our hearts are closing off in ill will a lot, and we wished we could do it better, even when you fall flat on your face and just mess it up, create a mess, your intention actually didn't go anywhere. Your deepest intention for wanting to live in a way. So let me ask you a question. It's a rhetorical, you don't have to answer. Just ask yourself, do you want to live, I'll just throw out some adjectives, you may have to use your own adjectives. Do you want to live in a way that's more kind and empathetic and compassionate, that's less reactive and more wisely responsive in life, that's more present and awake and clear and wise and skillful? Do you want to live in a way that creates less suffering for yourself and for others, and that creates more well-being for yourself and others? I may not have used the exact phrases for you, but some version of that, I'm guessing all of us would say, well, yeah. If you lose it and act in a way that's not in harmony with that, did that intention go away? No. It didn't. You just lost connection with it for a minute. We got entangled. We got caught up. And so I found it very freeing once when, I think I did share this story here once, I share it from time to time. I was coming out of a very long retreat. This was a one-year long retreat I did. And there were no bells or anything, just on your own, just sitting in a room, you know, meditating. I mean, yes, I came out to eat. And if I get lonely, I'd do my walking meditation outside where other people were walking or something. But, you know, just kind of sitting in the room, meditating. So, and it was intense and powerful in a lot of ways, right? As I was, I'll spare you the details. It's painful for me to this day, but let's just say I got in conflict with the first person I met when I stepped off the, after a year. Raised my voice. It's just painful now. The person said I barely even raised my voice at all, but it felt like yelling. I was so sensitive. I mean, in my defense, they didn't deserve it, but, you know, so, of course. But, so, you know, it wasn't my fault, though. Actually, if I told you, I won't give you the story. But, it was an intense situation I stumbled into. And I was on the receiving end of stuff, and I was real sensitive. Well, so I hadn't left the retreat center yet. This was the last week as I was going to leave. I was starting to integrate, so I was starting to talk a little. Went back to Joseph Goldstein was at the, he was my main teacher there. This is at the Forest Refuge. And I was in tears. I said, this whole retreat, waste for nothing. First, I'm sitting here and I'm merging in oneness with infinite love, literally in meditation. I mean, it's unbelievable what was happening. First person I meet, I think I called him a knucklehead or something, wasn't it? But I said, what is the matter with you? Are you crazy? Okay, I'll tell you, it was during the, so this was when the Forest Refuge first opened. I went there when it first opened between 2003 and 2004. Over that winter when I'd been on retreat, it was the whole Abu Ghraib thing in Iraq. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. God, I'm having all these feelings. It was so painful. So as I started integrating, I started going, oh, let me catch up on the news. And all this year's worth of whatever, Newsweek magazines, and there's that one person like standing on that thing with that hood. It was so painful. And I didn't have any boundaries. So it's just going in, right? And so you have this deep equanimity, but also you have this deep sensitivity. It's just a question of whichever one's going to win out. So a friend of mine who was an old college roommate who I hadn't talked to in years, somehow we connected, knew I was there on that retreat. I can't even remember why. I don't remember. And he said, well, come on, since you're breaking silence, come on, I'll take you out to eat. So he took me to some restaurant, and he hadn't changed since like college. I mean, he's got this hair down to here. Nothing wrong with that. He's chain smoking marijuana. He's cranking up the reggae music. Fine. But for me, I'm just like, okay. So he takes me to the restaurant, and he said something to me like, you know, Richard, I just hope you won't judge me too harshly because of whatever. I can't even remember what it was. And I said something like, Ed, come on, man, I'm not judging you for anything. It's great to see you. And this was my mistake. I said, just don't tell me you're a George W. Bush supporter. And by the way, I apologize. This is not about politics, because we don't all share the same politics. I don't assume that. So you can, if you don't like my politics, just substitute in your own. Bernie Sanders will do it for you. If you know, I'm more of a liberal. But and he said, well, you know, it's bad if you're wishing for the good old days of George W. Bush. Okay, I got one for you. So he said, well, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but not only am I a George W. Bush supporter, I'm a big George W. supporter. So I stood up. Would never do that. Well, I say I would never. Apparently, I would. I stood up and I said, what the hell is the matter with you? Are you nuts? And I sat down in tears and I'm like this. And it was so painful that I would say that to someone. It wasn't the worst thing. You know, I didn't curse more. I said hell, but you know. And then he did get a good one to me. He said, well, I see what eating all that tofu's done to you. Which I thought was a pretty good one. And we patched up. I said, listen, man, I'm sorry. I'm sensitive. You know, this is hard for me, but because it's okay, blah, blah, blah. And we're still, like, politically, but he's actually still a friend, you know, just one of these college friends. We just went in different directions. And that's when I went, that's what happened. It happened. I went back, and I was just in tears, like, oh, my God, how could I do that? I lost my equanimity. I lost everything. And Joseph Goldstein was so kind. He said to me two things. He goes, well, first of all, he pointed out that, you know, my sensitivity was high, and it just got ahead of the equanimity, and especially those images were so disturbing from on the covers. And so, you know, just went in, and he said, so give yourself a break. So he didn't even blink. He didn't judge me or anything. And the second thing he goes, he says, you know, he's talking about himself. He says, I've just learned long ago that, even talking about himself, he says, you know, we're going to fall flat on our face. This was, quote, flat on our face 1,000 times. And when we do, you know, and then I forgot, but it's basically, you know, if we've created a mess, let's try to clean up our mess the best we can. If you're, depending on what happened, sometimes that's not always possible. And just get back in touch with your intention. Always stay in touch with intention, And then keep going back to it. Even if we lose it, we can come back to it, back to it, back to it. And so, you know, the Buddha had, some of you may this word in Pali, you don't have to know the Pali, but it's manas, which is translated as conceit. And the Buddha basically said, you know, if you think you're better than someone else, that's conceit. But he also said, if you think you're less than or equal to someone else, that's conceit. Very interesting. And what he was pointing to is, it's a different way than we're used to thinking of it. It's the conceit of everything being so self-referential, like bouncing off of, how am I doing? Am I okay? And as a matter of fact, it's an interesting exercise if you've never done it. It can be shocking sometimes just to pay attention to your mind and notice what percentage of your thoughts are some version of, am I okay? I'm not okay. How am I going to be okay? All right, I'm okay, aren't I? Is this going to last? It's scheming, planning, for many people, it's a lot. We need a lot of compassion for ourselves. Like, how did we get in this situation? I don't want to live like that. But wow. So it's stepping out of that paradigm of just worrying about how we are, and not worrying sense, but applying ourselves in a wholesome way towards what is my intention now? And so we need to spend time getting clear about our intentions so we know ahead of time. You know, in Buddhism, we often spend so much time trying to learn about our suffering and what causes our suffering. You know, it's just as important to spend an equal amount of time connecting with everything that's good and right and beautiful and wholesome in us. So we have facility with it. We're fluent. It's just right there when we need it. So then you don't have to be scrambling around. Well, what's my intention? We know it's right there, and then it can come and be like an ally or support. If we need it, and you know, hopefully, you know, I'm not saying it's gonna do the trick every time, but it's like a touchstone or this post that you hold on to, and you don't let go when the forces are really pulling you. So, you know, when my friend on the had, who's the George W. Bush supporter or whatever, it's like, probably, look, I'm just going to have a feeling. It's just going to arise in me. There's no question about it. I could have, again, that wasn't the worst situation. I was sensitive. He said it was hardly anything, but, you know, it felt like a lot to me. And, you know, I lost my intention and I just got wrapped up, pulled by the energy of what happened. And so that can happen. Yeah. So there's this, I kind of went off. I was going to give a whole different talk. I'm going to go just a little bit longer, but not too much. So we have some time if people want to have questions, are okay, but if comments, anything. So the Buddha used these metaphors about being on fire. And and even talked about the discourse, which according to tradition is the third discourse the Buddha gave, which is called the Fire Sermon. It's actually literally the way of speaking of things as if being on fire, but it's called the Fire Sermon. And he says, we're on fire, metaphorically on fire. All of our senses, everything we see, hear, you know, they have what they call the six senses, probably many of you. There's the five, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, then body sensations they call touch. And then the sixth sense door in this model is the mind, because they call it the mind door, because it's just another way that we have mental experience. And through all of those six senses, we're on fire with what? Greed, hatred, and delusion. And the Dharma really is about putting out the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. How do we put out the fire? And in fact, if you go back to the first talk of the Buddha, called Setting in Motion the Wheel of the Dharma, in that, again, this is according to tradition. We don't really know what his first talk was, but the tradition is his first talk was on what's called the middle way, finding a balance between self-mortification and extreme asceticism on one hand and overindulgence and sensual pleasures on the other. That's what he would call the middle way. And then he gave it was the Four Noble Truths, and which included the Eightfold Path. Won't go into that now. Many of you know this. You know, if you stick around, if you're new, stick around the Dharma scene for any length of time. We'll have many, many talks on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path because it's part of our framework. But in the first Noble Truth, which is we're stuck with a poor translation because it's normally, it gives us a whole list of this is suffering, that's suffering, and then it says in short, it summarizes, it says, it's this weird phrase, it gets translated if we don't understand it. It says the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. What does that mean? The five aggregates of clinging are suffering. Well, let me put it this way, in a simplified way. there's a model called the five aggregates, which just deconstructs what it is to be a human being. Don't worry about what's in the, how the five, but it's our body and then different mental aspects, our consciousness. There's other mental activity. There's different just parts of the mind and the body. They sort of break down our psychology, our mental, our experience into what they call five different ways of breaking. Just like you can have six senses. You don't get experience just through seeing or just hearing. There's all of these. Well, there's all these mental processes going on. You have consciousness. You have what they call perception. What does it mean to perceive things? A specific meaning, different things, the body. So it's just a model. Just say you as a human being. Well, that word in Pali, what does it really mean? You don't need to know Pali, but this is a little interesting, actually. I'll explain it. It's a little tongue twister, but it's not that complicated. It's Panchupadana Khanda Dukkha. Pancha five, upadana clinging, khandas, five clinging khandas, or the just our dukkha, which is what we translate as suffering. But that word upadana, it has two meanings. It means clinging, it also means fuel for a fire. I think, and I didn't come up with this actually, Richard Gombrich, a great Sanskrit and Pali scholar, and there's a wonderful book called, some of you may have heard of the book called What the Buddha Taught by Walpola Rahula. Well, on a takeoff on that, Richard Gombrich, G-O-M-B-R-I-C-H, wrote a book on what the Buddha thought. And I like a lot of his book. And some of the book is okay, but he really hit a home run on this one. He's saying we've missed the metaphor. It's not saying the five aggregates of clinging are dukkha or suffering, because that's clumsy. He's saying the five burning, because it's fuel for a fire, the five burning masses of fuel are on suffering, are suffering. When you put out the fire, it's not suffering. It's that these are fuel that can be on fire with greed, hatred, and delusion, right from the fire servant. Different way of understanding dukkha, right? Because it's not true that life is suffering. It's not. Driving over here, I brought some food, and I brought there's a particular kind of dark chocolate that I really like. I like dark chocolate. When I'm eating dark chocolate, no suffering. Don't give me this Abhidhamma, whether it's the suffering of no, it's not suffering. Period. If I think that chocolate's going to do more for me than it's capable of doing, that's the greed, hatred, and delusion. I'm on fire with that. Now it's turned into suffering. So chocolate is still dukkha because it's inherently unreliable and unsatisfactory in the sense that it's not ultimately going to solve my problem. There's no experience I can have or not have that's ultimately going to solve my problem as just a human in this human condition. But the problem is I keep looking to the experiences to solve my problem. Let me ask you a question. Is there any experience, pick anything, any experience that didn't change, that you've ever had in your life? Any. It can feel like, I want to be respectful, if you're dealing with a chronic pain and it's not going, okay, you know, I want to, yes, I know I'm making a blanket statement. We can have things that can go on for a long time. And I feel very respectful about that. And I don't mean to be glib about people suffering. But I hope you get what we mean that, you know, I think for most of us, for most experiences, you know, we have, the unpleasant things happen and then it's change and the pleasant's here, it changes. It's just things just change. And so it goes back to the original thing I mentioned, I said when I started of we're going to keep aiming our lives how we want them to be and stop doing that. Set up the conditions the best you can, right? Pleasant, supportive conditions in your life. It'd be foolish not to do that. And then you get what you get. And it's a really shift, isn't it, to when something, quote unquote, goes wrong. You know, when I got stuck in traffic, nothing went wrong when I was going home from the airport. That's what happens when there's a lot of traffic. It's like this. Right? It's just like that. And it wasn't always that way. I don't even remember that now. All that suffering, now, I mean, I use it for a Dharma talk occasionally. Other than that, I wouldn't even remember that time. And when I was on that really long retreat, I was telling you, a year, you know, you're being months in and you're just in despair. Someday you're all blissed out. The next day, loneliness and despair. And it's like, I'm not going to make it. How, I can't bear sitting alone here one more moment. It's so painful. But I can't go home. I told all my friends I'm going for a year. What, you went home because you couldn't take it? Okay, I'm stuck. I got my image to protect. And then I would remind myself, a week from now, a month from now, a year from now, I'm not even going to remember this. And in fact, the incident I'm just thinking of right now, I don't remember. I just remember telling myself, whatever that thing was, I wouldn't remember it. These things are coming and going. So if we can learn how to shift things from, you know, I got to get or I got to not get, to how do I learn to be with, you know, at least do the best we can, I think it at least gives us a better chance to find a way to, right, to kind of maybe ride through the ups and downs and not be just at the mercy, not just get entangled with everything, either when it's so good, we're just all caught up in it, wow, this is great, and we're lost, or when it's so difficult, we get crushed by it. You know, we start to learn how to, and then expanding our circle, if you will, to be able to include more and more and more and more experiences and still rest in equanimity. That's kind of the path. And so then I'm going to end, then to me, all these practices that we do, that's just the training of our hearts and minds to give us more tools so we have we're better able then to do that, better able to not just get entangled and caught up, and better able to find the equanimity, the cliche of inner peace. It's a cliche, but I mean, so things become cliches because, you know, I don't know if every cliche does. I haven't thought this through, but, you know, they're so true and they're just said over and over, right? So anyway, I'll stop there. So thank you for kind attention. I appreciate it. And I know at 10 till, we'll make a shift. So we have about 5 minutes. I'm sorry I went. So we don't have much time if anybody does want to. You can say anything or questions, whatever. No, that's fine. Yes, please. Yes, please.
It's the last resort to just be with it. Why can't we just come to it as the first resort? That would save a lot of time and trouble.
That would save a lot of time. Did you all hear that? Yeah, so if we could just, instead of trying to fix it. Yeah, well, I guess I like to think it's, well, so it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
But so that would be probably the best first resort, wouldn't it? But what I would say happens to me, perhaps, is that while I'm being skillful and wise and using all my tools to, you know, I think what I was really doing, to be honest with you, all those tools to learn how to work with it skillfully and be more calm and settle my nervous system rather than to go right to be with it, probably was some version of get away from me, get this away from me. And then finally, I'm a tough case. It hits me over the head enough times and it's finally, oh, okay. Just can I be with it? I'm a tough case. Sometimes it's got to beat me over the head with it.
It's aversion. You don't like what's happening. And you're doing everything to change it.
Yeah. I was backpacking with my wife once, and we were about 2 days into a backpacking trip, And for those of you who are backpackers, you know, you get these bear cans where they're bear proof. You put your food in there, and the bear can't get in. And so at night, you put them like however far away from your tent. But, you know, we were just set up right up next to the tent. So the bear still couldn't get in there, but it was near us. In the middle of the night, my wife wakes me up and is like, it's a bear. It's a bear right there going for the bear can. Now I know that the California black bear is not interested in people. And when I'm in the campground in Yosemite, I'll come out and I'm all brave. And I've got my pots and pans and I scare it away and no big deal. Come on, bear, get out of here. But we were 2 days out in the middle of nowhere. And my wife said, well, what should we do? And I said, well, we could either get out of the tent and bang pots and pans together to scare it away, or we could lie here in the sleeping bags and quiver like a leaf. And I said, I vote for lying here in the sleeping bag and quiver like a leaf. And literally the adrenaline, you know, you hear this, but it's never happened to me before, ever, before, since. I literally was shaking like a leaf. I mean, it's like, oh, my God, it's real. And the fear was so bad. And then my wife said, let's send Metta to the bear. So we're going, may you be happy. But you know what I was, really, really saying? Go away, Mr. Bear, go away. It was so unpleasant. You know, it's just hard to be present when it's really, really hard. Maybe one more. We don't have much time. We're cutting to the time. Yes, please.
I just want to thank you for being so refreshingly honest about your practice. I find it very useful for myself, and it was also very joyful. So.
Oh, okay. Well, I appreciate that. That's very kind. I appreciate your kindness.